desert wild and free rides the Sheik of Araby, his Arab band at his command. Ah, follow his love's caravan under the shadow of the palms. He sings to call her to his arms. Hold together, gang. Let's go. Hey, come on, let's go. One, two, three, four. Come on out. Get those knees going. I'm the Sheik of Araby. Oh, your love belongs to me. At night, when you're asleep, sleep, sleep, into your tent, I'll creep, creep, creepity, creep. The stars that shine above, oh, will light our way to love. You'll rule this land with me. Oh, I'm the Sheik of Araby. I'm the Sheik of Araby. Your love belongs to me, baby, baby. At night, when you're asleep, wah, 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 into your tent, I'll creep, creep, creepity, creep. Oh, the stars that shine above, will light our way. Love, 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 you'll rule. You'll just blow that thing, man. Just land with me. Wah, wah, I'm the Sheik. Wah, 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 I'm the Sheik.
Scary, you know, this love business. Well, I'm telling you, not more than a half an hour ago, I got really, you know, it's a kind of thing you can take or leave alone. You know, it's terrible how outspoken our world is getting. It's getting so outspoken now, it's scary. I'm in this jazzy East Side restaurant, and I'm with this jazzy East Side chick. You know, the kind of, well, you know. When we tell yay, all the way down, you know, the whole business, you know, the satin mink girdles and all of it, and everything's sleek. And so she says, may I have some cigarettes? They always want cigarettes immediately going to these places, see. And so, you know, they've got these special slot machines in these East Side joints where it's 50 cents. You know, they don't accept nothing less than a half a slug. And so I go over to this big, beautiful stainless steel slot machine right next to the bar, and I throw in my half a slug. Of course, she smokes gawa, naturally. And I throw the thing in there, and I look around, gawa, and I'm looking past all the wings and the spuds and all the various 20 grand. They still have them over there on the East Side, you know, because it's a very conservative crowd on the East Side. Some of those guys still smoke Marvels over there. And they have wings and spuds, and there in the right middle of it is Galois. And Galois, I throw the half a buck in, ooing, and the thing goes, gung, 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 ka-tung, down it comes. And right there, along with it, comes this red match cover. Well, I don't think anything about it, you know. I give the chick the Galois, I hand her the match cover, and right there, and this great big red match cover in enormous black letters is... Oh, boy. All I got to say is it's the stuff that they always talked about in those special movies that they had for us, the GIs, you know, when Fred Stone, Lewis Stone, you remember old Lewis Stone, would get up and he says, as an officer of the Army Medical Corps, man, it is my duty. And he starts pulling those charts down with those guys. They'd open their mouths and go, if I can help all the troops, And you know, all of a sudden these fantastic visions are marching through my head, and I'm looking at this beautiful cameo chick, and on there, and she, without even so much as losing a beat, she opens that match cover, and there are those two great big black letters shining out in that East Side joint. Oh. You know, I don't like this kind of... this terrible commentary on private life. I mean, it's getting just awful. You know, here I've been thinking of a great evening, and all of a sudden you talk about wet blankets being thrown all over the place. I don't know whether you've got one of these match covers, friends, but you remember the old days when they said, please close cover before striking? Well, they say other things now on these match covers. Oh. And they come out free with the cigarettes. You know, what are you gonna...
gang of mine, by God, I'd like to see them. Sir, I knock off a jackpot and sit and talk and yell and holler and snort and whistle.
Hello, crowd. How are you? God's sakes, how are you?
You're standing up straight tonight, aren't you? It's Friday.
Well, it won't be long.
Yeah, we'll all win in the next world, won't we, crowd? Yeah. Yeah, we'll get our reward, won't we? That's a scary thought. Yes, a great reward there. I mean, has it ever occurred to you, have you ever read these great slogans that says that you always get what you earn? Have you ever always had the feeling that you someday will get what you've worked for? Wouldn't it be terrible if it happened? I mean, if you really got what you really were worth? Oh, boy. Because, you know, about 97% of our whole civilization is based on getting as much as you can for as little as you can put out. And the more you can sell for nothing, the more you can phony yourself up, the really better off you'll be. Come on, let's go, Tony, old man. The better... Yes, indeed. Well, all right. Hold it. Come on now. This is the new shepherd. This is 1964. This is not that old, rotten old world. 1963. We're very, very serious now. And I am serious, by the way. If those of you who would like to know what was said on that match cover, we will send this only to sociological students, students of advanced medicine, and art students. You must be over 21. Send your name and address to Whoopie Time, care of WOR, John Gambling, Department of Deep Thinking. Here we'll... He'll take care of that, and ask him. I'll tell you. Why don't we do that? Why don't all of you? I'll tell you that would shock poor old John right out of his Norman Lubov choir. You know, seriously, John would be shocked right out of his skull if he gets 17,000 cards saying John Gambling. What did it say on that match cover? Be careful, Dad. He'd find out, you know. I see John going around here with those gray vests and worried look. But that's not a bad idea, come to think of it. They'd know I'm here then. Seriously, if you really want to get a delayed gag going, all of you send a card as quick as you can to John Gambling. What was on the card, Gambling? It's all right. Just send it in care of John Gambling here. WOR, he'll take care of that. And that's in care of Sirius Radio Division of WOR. They're in charge of time, temperature, and all important things in our life. Speaking of important things in our life, you know, I don't know whether or not you are as amused by the whole conceit of showbiz, the whole conceit of the art and the theater and the various other razzmatazz, razzle-dazzle, jazzy things that we're involved in our world. And, of course, it's all done with the greatest of implications. That's a fantastic art form. Somehow, a guy that writes the most moldy three-act comedy somehow relates himself to Aeschylus. He really does. And what's so funny, so does Arlene Francis. They get on there, you know, and they're interviewed and all that, you know. And I wonder if Euripides would ever get on the David Susskind show, you know, those rotten women he wrote about. But that... Nevertheless, it's funny how we really do. We take the trivia today, and somehow we've got the... It's like we're all involved in a big game of, like, pretending. Seriously, I mean that. You know, it's like every... Have you had the... You must have had the experience. In fact, there's probably 9 million guys right now listening who are going through this particular kind of hell. And that's the experience of being with somebody. You're riding along in your Mercury, you know, and you're going along, and you're pretending you're having a great time. And, oh, boy, and that's really rotten. And she is pretending she's having a great time. She's, oh, look at that interesting sign over there, the one on the other side of the pizza joint. And he looks, yeah, gee whiz, that's very interesting. And he looks out of the window, and then she says, what are you looking at? He says, did you see that? That was a 37 Ford that went past. She says, oh. And they go on and on. It's this kind of, you know, it's a pretense. And I just wonder how many million guys are going home to families that they pretend they love. You know, and you know what I mean? It's a very difficult thing. And how many mothers are living with kids they're pretending they dig? Oh, boy. And living with a man that has turned out to be a toad, you know, all the way down the line, and you cannot admit this to yourself, Because, you know, where are you going to go? So here you are living with this giant toad. And it's sitting there, and its feet once in a while scratch on the linoleum. And occasionally it opens its mouth and goes, ah. And that's about all it does. You know, ah, and then falls asleep. Just like a toad. You know? And on the other hand, many a guy has married this fantastic sylph-like creature, which is in his own mind, of course, you know. He has married this will-o'-the-wisp, which is scurrying ahead of him always in the burberry bushes up there ahead with a darkening light. And finally he gets her, and suddenly 6 months later he looks up and he sees that he is married to what appears to be one of the lesser known of the Marjorie Main group. And you know, and she's sitting there and says, hey, will you shut up out there, all you kids? This old lady is yelling and hollering. She says, when are you going to take me to the show? All I do is sit around her all day long with the iron in my hand. All the time. Well, so he's got to pretend, and we have to go through life pretending that we're serious. We have to go through life pretending that we're really concerned over social conditions. I wonder how many guys are pretending that they're concerned over, let's say, the integration problem. They even get to the point where they have to pretend. It gets so hard to pretend that they have signs printed up. They put on their back. You know? Oh, yeah. I just wonder how many guys sitting in audiences around listening to folk music are pretending they're really interested in this social struggle. Yeah, you tell them, Bob. Oh, boy. And of course, how many performers are pretending? That's even the saddest one. They're out there, bang, oh, how many years can a man walk alone? You know, they're working away there. And it's all some kind of a giant, wonderful mushroom that everybody... And what's even more fascinating is that even often you will find many of the sufferers are pretending they're suffering. Which is even more, you know, it gets all convoluted. So, you don't know where it stops, where it starts, where anything begins, you know. And so, somehow, it's all related in a way to showbiz. So, finally today, I suspect that almost everybody, somehow, is some kind of a player. Really, literally, taking the Shakespearean phrase literally. So, you know, because when you were living in the frontier, you know, it was not much time to play with all those things biting you. Yelling and hollering and hitting stuff and trees falling on you. You know, it was work. I mean, it was really, you were involved. You couldn't, you know, an alligator doesn't play alligator, you know, when the things are yelling at him and stuff is biting and he's got to bite back and all that. So as we have come more and more into a technical civilization, and all of this stuff has been removed, you know, there's very few guys. One of the byproducts of a technical civilization, of course, is part of the play world of pretending that it isn't. And so the other day, I went up to a very hip record place. These guys are at 1290 6th Avenue. This building is made out of Reynolds wrap, you know? It's aluminum, and it's got green glass. It looks like the control tower at Idlewild, you know, and all kinds of little silent elevators go on up and down. And everything is automatic, completely. The walls are made of this formica, and it's everything. And music is coming out. It's an automatic building. Well, I get up to the top of this building there, and I go in to see these guys, and it's a fantastic record place. It's built out of chrome and all that stuff. And one of the doors open, and out comes a guy wearing a lumberjack jacket, and he had on combat boots. Hey, let's go, Mac! And he walks out, and he's playing like he is somewhere near the Oregon Trail. Roughly the year is 1846. And he's got a scraggly prospector's beard. He does not have a Mr. Schweppes beard. He's got the kind of beard that a guy grows because he's lost on the mountainside for 115 days with a can of pemmican. And this guy comes out, and he walks along over to the elevator, and the other guy dragging behind him is dressed like a Georgia chain gang native. And he's coming along, and they're both carrying old rotten guitars. And both of them, by the way, I happen to know both of them, are from Short Hills, New Jersey. Which is a very esoteric town. I mean, you know, a lot of automatic stuff there. So these two guys, and I think, what is it, you know? And say, hey, man, you heard our record. And they start playing their tape for me, and they're singing about problems that were solved roughly 75 to 100 years ago. You know, like the Chisholm Trail, you know, like being waylaid by the Indians near the Snake River. You know, this whole scene, and these guys are serious about it. They're really serious. They go through hell every night on the old movies with Gary Cooper. They really do. They have fought many a wagon. Speaking of hell, this is WOR AM and FM New York. It's funny. This chain of sequences here. And we have with us Charles Gounod's Faust will be heard as the season's fifth live Metropolitan Opera. That's funny, applying the word live to Gounod's Faust. Do they know what Faust is about? Oh, boy. Well, anyway, in the cast during this broadcast will be tenor Barry Morrell as Faust and soprano Anna Maffo in the role of Margarita. Bass Cesare Cieffi will be heard as Mephistopheles. Do you know, I played Mephistopheles. I did, really, literally, in a version of Faust, an opera. It was great. Believe me, the devil has all the best lines ever, forever, ever. There's no question about it. It's a terrible unequal battle. It really is. And every time I would arrive on the scene, Mephistopheles, you know, everybody, you'd feel that in the audience, you'd feel them all perking up, you see, somehow. It's going to happen again. He's going to really say it. The devil, of course, is going to lead us out. And, of course, he always wins. So tomorrow at 2 o'clock, Mephistopheles and Faust. I was disappointed with the way that winds up, though. It's very unreal. See, I think Mr. Gounod, and in fact, Goethe, too, were wishful thinking. To go into an analysis of Faust, we won't tonight. However, speaking of Faust and Forever Youngsville, we have with us the Pottery of All Nations tonight. We'll get this stuff out of the way. And they're down on Sheridan Square in the village. And if they busted all your glasses over the weekend and during Christmas and broke all the ashtrays and stole all the stuff off the walls, I would like to suggest that you visit the Pottery of All Nations, which is worth a visit any time. They give free coffee and you can stand around there and scratch. And, you know, it's free. And it's down on Sheridan Square, and they have imported pottery of one kind or another. It's the only place I know in town where they have these Italian wine measuring things, and they're loaded. They confiscated all of these from Naples, where they were using short weights, and they're available now. They have the seal of Naples on it, Napoli. You know the mafia. Well, nevertheless, this is Pottery of All Nations on Sheridan Square. There's one at 64th and Lex, and one over in Jersey on Route 4. The giant drive-in pizza state. Speaking of giant drive-in pizzas, while we're on the subject, we have speaking of the whole business of the theater and the strange, convoluted world that we're living in, one of my spies just recently was over there working in the World's Fair area there. And he said, in fact, he was going through there doing some kind of work, and he says, there's a sign that must be reported. It is a sign of what the World Fair and Way is going to be like. There is a building, and it has a big sign, and it says World's Fair, 1964 to 65, Identity Building. There's one to mull over. All right, I'll see you at the Identity Building right after I leave the Billy Graham Pavilion. And somehow I like the idea of the Identity. There's another building over there called the Festival of Gas. And they have a restaurant, ironically enough. I don't know. Oh, you know, it's getting good. Here they do. I'll meet you at the Festival of Gas restaurant, baby. How romantic can you get? How realistic can you get? I kind of like the idea of the Identity Building. And he said, what's so scary? It said Identity Building. And underneath it, it said Temporary. Which is even more scary. Of course, we're living in a world where things are coming right out. They're beginning to say it, like that match cover. While on the subject of saying it, there is a little piece in one of the columns, which I think unconsciously is one of the funniest statements about showbiz. And I think one of the things that showbiz does, even the theater, particularly the theater, it takes genuine problems and reduces them to a scene that Jerry Page can cry about. And so everyone somehow feels that it's, you know, something's happened now. They feel better about it and they go marching on. I know people really who think they're making a major, literally a major contribution to understanding and the racial problems today by buying a Joan Baez record. They really do, and playing it on their stereo over on East End Avenue. And so, you know, it's just the way the scene goes. But I think this is in the same department. Here's a little note. It says, David Niven will have to wait another year before he can star in Brave New World for Sam Bronston in Madrid. I kind of like the idea of Sam Bronston. You know the kind of movies he makes? You ever seen his? As Seed and all that stuff. Charlton Heston galloping against the Saracens and stuff. Well, somehow Mr. Bronston is going to make Brave New World. Script problems. Those of you who are worried about Brave New World, you know anything about the script of Brave New World? You know anything about the book? Well, they've got script problems, friends, as you already have anticipated. If you know the book, script problems. They're trying to figure out how to make it come out happy. Yeah, you know. It's going to be a musical, see. Script problems. A pity that author Aldous Huxley is not around for consultations. Indeed, he probably would blow his stack if he were. But nevertheless, a few days before his death from a few days ago, Aldous had an hour-long conversation on the phone with his close friend, Franklin Lacey, who has written a musical version of Brave New World. The topic of their talk was the inevitability of pain and death. They're trying to write a song on that subject, and I you know, Dave will sing and dance to it. And you know, you don't know how, you know... You don't know whether... I don't know whether I'm as good as I used to be on fielding fast ground balls. I can still go to my right, though, by George. I'll tell you that. I fielded that one going away. I got it in the webbing of the glove. I didn't know I had it. Turned it into a neat double play. Well, now we're on the... As long as we're on the subject of this, we might as well go all the way. Speaking of the world of showbiz. And how differently people react to the unreal world. You know, have you ever thought of what would happen if the thing that you're bugged about actually occurred? I wonder, no, seriously, if you know, everybody believes in, say, things like equality and freedom, how would you feel if it happened? Seriously, you don't think, oh yeah, I think that's great. But think seriously about it for a minute. Really think seriously about it. Why, can you imagine a heaven where nobody has any rank? Especially you? Boy, that would really bug Mailer. I'll tell you. I mean, really, equality. I'm seriously. And it sounds like I'm talking against equality. What I'm really saying here is that many of the things that we use as great, you know, great generalities, we really never even think about them as actually being real or true. Peace, for example, has obviously bored the daylights out of 97.9% of the population. You know, everybody's talking about war. There's more guys can get mad about war, and there's been no war for 20 years, you know. And they're still loud. Nobody's going to send me to war. And what do you mean, send you to war? Who's talking about sending you to war? It's like, we'll come to you, but who's talking about sending you to war, you know? And yet, I guess, I've come to the conclusion from having worked with a few of these guys that the more people make movies, the more guys, it's just a kind of word, it's kind of rule of thumb. The more people you see hung on, say, such a word as love, don't have it. In fact, I read recently, just to give you an example of that, I read recently one of the folk music groups, a trio, and they use this word just like other guys use fill it up, you know, or other guys use words like charge it. Well, folk groups use the word love. It just comes out just as natural, I mean, as hello, goodbye, and no, I don't want any. You know, these words just come out just as easily and slip out there. Well, anyway, in this piece, it tells about this group. You see, they're talking. And one of the leaders of the group says, well, one thing, our group, just we just dig love. We have love. We have plenty of love. That's what we have, plenty of love. Love, we have plenty of love. End of statement. Well, I can never imagine the Andrews sisters saying that. For that matter, I can never imagine anyone who really has it saying it. I have never known anyone who says, one thing about me, I'm funny. I mean, anyone who was. I never heard Benchley ever say that. And yet, it is this use of a word, the self-conscious use of a word, which betrays, in a very deep sense, the lack of the very thing that people are proclaiming. Now, let's take for example, this business of protest. A very interesting thing. I've seen in my limited experience that many of the people who make anti-war movies dig war the most. They love to be generals. They love to stand up there. All right, Rip Torn. Okay, now look, you guys, all you infantrymen over there on the left, when Torn goes up the hill there and attacks the pillbox, I want the camera to pan right, and I want you machine gunners to give them hell. Okay. I don't want any fooling around. I want war here. Boom, boom. Very good. Cut. That was great. Hey, yeah, pick him up. Oh, look, I told you guys not to hit him, actually. Oh, I'm sorry about the blood. Yeah, okay.
Well, the more people protest, the more it is. And I'm curious how many peace marchers really like peace.
just a curiosity. Many psychologists, of course, will... Of course, nobody listens to psychologists. It's psychiatrists that we're interested in. and a psychologist will tell you more about yourself than a psychiatrist ever will. One is a therapist, and the other just sits and looks and makes his observations. But nevertheless, there is some evidence to this. Now, what would happen, say, for example, if you know, somebody's out in front protesting you thought, or just take anything. We protest the Hungarian delegation. Well, all right, what would you do if you're out there protesting at your sign, you know, you're protesting some delegation, and all of a sudden the guy comes out and hits you? He says, oh, yeah, well, I protest you. Bang, he hits you in the mouth. Well, now, we accept, you see, what we do, we accept the one-way protest. In other words, we always suspect that there's just two kinds of people. There's good guys and rotten guys. And the good guys are the protesters, invariably. And the rotten guys are the guys that are protested against. This is an assumption that is always made. So to take a lesson from that, you better learn to protest. Protest inevitably. To be a protester against whatever is bugging you, people will automatically assume then you're right, literally. They will assume you're right because they say, you know, he's got a lot of truth going there. Well, the other day, A wild protest incident occurred, and again, this could not occur here in America. Give me my British music. This is the only place where it could happen here.
Oh my God! Heard once again the BBC third program. Thank you. I salute to Britishers and Englishmen everywhere. We'll fight them from the hedgerows. We'll fight them with blood, sweat, and tears. The Empire will survive. Thank God there's an Englishman. The BBC and its special third program, Services for the Empire Around the Globe, salutes two very special Englishmen. First, from London. As a young political worker sees it, Science Minister Quentin Hogg packs a good political wallop, even though the elderly ex-PR didn't win a smashing election victory Thursday in London. The youth says the cabinet member, the former Lord Hailsham, sucked him in the eye. Lord Hogg denies the charge, but a storm is brewing. I was completely shocked that a minister of the crown should hit someone, said Roy Gundon, displaying his shiner and his newsman as he put down his protesting sign. Gundon's secretary for the Southeast Incident Youth Protesters League yesterday afternoon protested outside the Marlborough Town Hall after Thursday local election on general principles, as he put it. Hogg won the district, but yielded more than 10,000 votes from his Conservative Party's 1959 showing. When the elderly minister stopped to pose for photographers, Grundon raised his sign, said he held a poster behind Hogg's head, and the sign said, "Young liberals want full rights at 18. Shame!" Well, another young Liberal Party worker, protester, pulled the poster in front of Hogg's face as they were about to photograph him, but Hogg suddenly tossed it to the floor, Grundon said. I passed him and picked up the poster, again raising it above my head, and while holding it at waist level, smiled at him. Mr. Hogg then punched me in the eye. In his denial, Hogg said, a liberal poster was thrust over my head. I am a conservative. A liberal poster was thrust over my head and in front of my face as I left the very town hall. I was blinded by it and angered by it. And thinking I heard approaching steps, and being afraid of falling, I pulled it aside. I struck no one. Well, the witnesses don't agree with Mr. Hogg. The Liberal Party's floor manager in the House of Commons, Eric Lubbock, says he has now demanded a full investigation of this terrible thing. Miss Quetta Whitehorn, a Labor Party official, said she witnessed the incident actually, and she said there was a group of young liberal hecklers, demonstrators round Mr. Hogg, when suddenly the gentleman punched out. Yes, a man was hit fair and square in the face. And to me, it looked like a good right hook. By God, we salute Lord Hogg tonight. A good right hook to the jaw, you whippersnapper. Idiotic. Liberal posters. From Madeira, among the Laconia survivors, was an Englishman in a lifeboat. Dressed in a neat suit, natty topcoat, and carrying a briefcase. He refused helping hands
and climbed aboard the Argentine rescue ship Salta completely unaided. When the Salta's third officer congratulated him on his cool behavior, he replied after a short pause, "Sir, I am an Englishman."
And so tonight we salute two very special Englishmen, an unknown top coat, whereof, who said it for all of us, and the Lord Sir Percival Hawk, who swings a nice fry book, liberal posters up. And so, the third program concludes tonight's special broadcast. A salute to Englishmen and the English spirit forever and fight me. We'll fight them from the hedgerows. My God, thank God there's an Englishman. Stay tuned for the Lady Whitson Whiteson Whitson's very special program on geraniums in the fall and late afternoon clippings.
Okay, all right. That's enough of that now. So, you know, it's going on everywhere you look. Guys are fist fighting it out. Speaking of fist fighting it out, and as long as we've got the opera here, the opera, I don't know whether you know too much about the opera. Let me tell you this. With my little experience involving myself with the opera world, which has been very, very short and at one time very, very concentrated, I believe that probably of all the forms of the theater, perhaps even including life itself, there is more nuttiness in the world of the opera than any other form of showbiz that I have ever heard tell of. Believe me, I don't know whether you've ever been backstage at an opera. Oh, boy. And then you understand, I don't know why a guy can be backstage at an opera for more than 10 minutes and still not know why war is inevitable in mankind's time. Really, I just don't understand this. But nevertheless, there it is. Boy, I'll tell you, I've seen women walk across. Have you ever seen women with actual fangs? I mean, it's funny, you know. Not, I don't mean symbolic. I mean actual. I know one woman in the opera world who I was amazed to see with the only time I ever saw her with these open-toed shoes, she's got real claws. You know, she walks across the stage and you hear them scratching. You know, it's a fascinating. I mean, or it's a real wild scene. Well, speaking of the opera world, there's another thing happened in the world of the opera, which, because to the opera kind of lends itself to that, both on the side of the audience and on the side of the people who perform it. There is just something in the air. I don't know. When you get those Rhine maidens swimming upstream and you got Wagner going full blast down there in the orchestra pit, and you got all those big fat girls sitting up there in the balcony and all those very thin young men, you've got a pot brewing over there that I'm telling you has to be seen and felt to be believed. Well, in Vienna, now, the opera in Vienna, of course, is a very special thing. A very special thing. And I have a special report from the New York Times, which it's on the nutty page, but it's just part of the little news items that come out of the world. And it's from Vienna. Vienna, a woman about 70 years old sang the part of Violetta in Verdi's La Traviata last night in a theater especially rented for what was billed as her farewell performance. A very interesting farewell performance. For those of you who collect farewell performances, and there are many of you who do, this one perhaps might be a collector's item. The presentation in the Raymond Theater was an audience success, actually, of sorts, but an artistic disaster, if I might use my critical prerogatives here. The leading lady used the name Gina Hermisa. It was rumored today that the theater had been rented for the occasion by her indulgent American husband. Well, you know those Americans. I can only say this. Last night at the opera, I was treated to such a spectacle as I never thought I would see in Vienna. This drunk birth of Americans. I would like to say this about the Americans. Listen very carefully. She disappeared after the performance. Now, listen carefully to this. The supporting cast and the orchestra were from the Raymond and State Opera companies. These are very good companies. Do you know them? Of course you know. Tickets were distributed free to invalids and old people, and 1,400 people, including me, attended last night. The show went on as a kind of tragic comedy. The only thing I can say, it was tragic and comedy at the same time, in which the audience laughed
We sat there and laughed out our sides last night at Miss Elmiza and suffered along with the orchestra. They were struggling. You never heard the orchestra try to go along. It was a terrible thing. There's all those good musicians and the supporting players standing around. Miss Elmiza sang when it pleased her. She just sang whenever she felt like singing. They would stand and all of a sudden she would sing to La Traviata, La Violetta. Several times, yes, sir, that's my baby, some American song. The conductor stopped trying to please or to cue her. He said later on when I talked to him backstage in the green room, he says, well, I pretended she wasn't there, actually. I just stood there and scratched and went and went and went through and say singly to myself and I get the tubas going and I pretend like she wasn't there. That's all the way I can do it. Miss Elmiza was stormily applauded and this we deplore actually terrible after her stage death as Violetta incidentally where she laid down there and waved at the audience in the stage death, waved at the audience and cackled away there. She took 12 curtain calls. 12 curtain calls. I have seen the great gala. Could she only get 8 in the same role? This lady takes 12 curtain calls. The performance cost actually $6,000. It was a crime. Terrible thing. I cannot see what's happening to the world and all kinds of terrible things. Well, we will be back tomorrow night at the same time with the upper commentary. Dr. Damarone will be speaking at the board tonight, and I will be here tomorrow night to tell you how awful it was. Terrible things going on.
Oh, boy. You know, speaking of the fears of I suppose you have to come from a place where the world is kind of real, where there are storms and where there are tornadoes, where there are great lashing waves and icebergs just offshore, to have even a vague understanding of what all of this kind of gallimaufry is about, you know. As a matter of fact, I've often debated telling the awful story of the ice boat. Have any of you ever had anything to do with an ice boat? You haven't? Well, I don't think most New Yorkers have. Most New Yorkers' idea of a really big, wild, very exciting afternoon in the outdoors is to wait for a cab for 7 minutes in front of Schrapp's on 53rd Street, you know, and they complain bitterly. And of course, the business of going up and skiing on the weekend is a jokey. Let me tell you, that's greasy kid stuff to anybody who's really fought the elements, you know. I mean, it's mostly a matter of wearing the right clothes up there, you know, and these mountains up there, Sugarloaf and all that. They stand around and talk to each other and drink champagne and holler and read Playboy and wave out, you know, the whole scene. Well, it was very different. I'll tell you, I'm this kid, and this is part of showbiz, and it scares the daylights out of me when I think of it. I don't even like to think of this thing. Have you ever been involved in something that you started going? You started it going, you know, like say even think, you know, some nutty human relationship. You started it, and before long, you had an avalanche rolling down from the top of K2. It was coming down on you from the top of Everest and getting bigger and bigger, and you're hanging on to it like a gigantic bowling ball, and there you are with your thumb stuck in it, and you don't know what to do, you know? Well, I had a thing, which again, you know, we all have little lessons that we carry along through life. Well, one time, I'm about 16, I figure, 17 maybe. I think I was about a senior in high school. And it was a very, you know, at that age, there's a very romantic period begins to set in. A romantic where you're putting everybody down, your old man, you're putting the whole world down, you figure you really know what it's all about. You should have heard me on the subject of politics when I was 17. Let me tell you, boy. I mean, if you think Lenny Bruce is a put-down cat, me at 17, listen, my old lady used to belt me in the mouth every 7 minutes. Well, nevertheless, I'm about 17, see, and there was a guy in the neighborhood named Doppler. Well, Doppler and I suddenly got the idea, where it came from, out of the air. We got the idea not only out of the air, but out of popular mechanics. And the idea was to build an ice boat. Well, now, an ice boat, you know, boats sound very nice to you. You know, a boat sounds like a pleasant sort of Huntington-Hartford sport, you know. The kind of thing where you sit there with your jib braced against the lee and your jaw squared and your eyes looking out to sea, you know, and you're bronzed. Oh, you know that thing. Well, we found out that you could build an ice boat for about $12, which between us we almost had. And so we decided to build one. Have you ever seen an ice boat?
Let me tell you what happened on that ice boat. Doppler and I worked on the ice boat in his garage for roughly a month. It was just about this time of the year when we were doing it. And we're out in that cold and the wind is howling past the eaves. And every Saturday, Doppler and I are working on this big frame. It looks like a big kite frame, really. It's like a big T, big kite frame. And we had gotten a hold of an old mast somewhere down on the shipyards on the lakefront. We had the whole thing going. And after about a month, we actually had this thing built up and had taken it out and put it on a place called Wolf Lake near Chicago. Big, long stretch of ice. Well, we could see off in the distance there were guys with ice boats. You could see them way off there. We had never even seen an ice boat. That's something you got to understand. We had just built one out of plans. Never seen one. And so Doppler and I rigged the sail. And it's cold. We're sitting there with our earmuffs on and our sheepskin coats. And Doppler is pushing the thing around. We put the sail up. It starts to tug. Well, I'll tell you this. It starts. It felt real good, you know. And we had put this board across where we could both sit on each side to give the thing kind of, you know, balance. And so he's sitting on one side. I'm sitting on the other side. And we start paying off the ropes and working the tiller. And the thing starts slowly moving. Hey, this is great, Doppler. We're moving like Doppler says, wow, all right, come on, hold the rope. Hey, quit swinging back. All right, hold on. It starts picking up speed. Hey, whoa, oh, hey, oh. And it starts picking up more speed. All right, Doppler, hang down there. Put your foot down. I'm going to turn here. Woo! We make a turn, and we're digging the ice and sending up spray. Well, let me tell you, after about 5 minutes of this, this thing is going about 115 miles an hour. Doppler is in hysterics, screaming and hollering, and I am laying flat, and the ice is going under me in a screaming, fantastic blur, and we are whistling towards the dunes and open water. Woo! It's going like mad. Well, Doppler is hanging on. He says, what are we going to do, Shep? And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get off. He said, you can't get off. It's going 100 miles an hour. Help, help. And the other ice boat guys are kind of looking at us. They're off 30 yards away. We don't know what to do. We go screaming past a guy with an orange sail. Woo! 150 miles an hour. The thing is working beyond our greatest dreams. Doppler says, I'm going. Woo! Off he goes. Doppler slid at least 2 miles, flat out on his gut. And I said, what am I going to do? And with that, the ice boat flips, and down I go. Ooh, off towards Benton Harbor. The ice boat kept right on going into open water. Thank God. I'm still here.